from? And where are we going?
Welcome, friends. This is Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I am the editor and webmaster of RedIceCreations.com. Thank you for tuning in to our internet talk radio show. We are recording from Sweden. If you are new to the program, just let me remind you that Red Ice Creations Radio is available with a new show every Thursday and Sunday. Our archives go back to a year, all free stuff for you there to enjoy. We also have a subscriber section for you guys who want to have a little bit more and at the same time make sure that we're able to keep things going here, bring you fascinating news and interesting radio. All right, I'm very glad that you're here with us today. I'm excited about today's program because we have back with us on the show author, researcher, speaker, and legend Jim Mars. Jim Mars, of course, is behind a few titles such as Rule by Secrecy, Alien Agenda, and the most recent book is called The Terror Conspiracy, just to name a few. And Jim's website that you need to check out is simply jimmars.com. That's Mars with two R's. So, it's a real pleasure to welcome back to the program Mr. Mars. Hey Jim, thank you so much for coming on. It's great to have you back.
It is good to be back, and thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. How are you, and how are things down there in Texas?
Well, I'm doing all right, just plugging away, working on some new books, and things in Texas right now look pretty good. We've had kind of a wet spring, and everything's green and lush.
Yeah, I saw that very nice picture of you on the website. We're sitting by the roadside with some nice flowers there. So.
Oh yeah, sitting in the bluebonnets that come out just for a short period of time each spring in Texas, and they those are the bluebonnets that line the highway out in front of my house. They're quite beautiful.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I would love to begin today to talk a little bit, if you want to, of course, but I recently saw National Geographic's the documentary called Freemasons on Trial, and you appeared in that. Had a little spot there, a few minutes off and on. Have you seen the entire piece yet, Jim?
Yes, I did.
Do you remember it at all? I don't know if this was maybe a long time ago.
That was shot some time back. I'm not. I'm a little hazy on all that.
But you're appearing in a few of these documentaries. On and off. I guess there are a number of those out there. But you might.
It kind of surprises me that everyone wants to come and interview me, but when I try to pitch them to do a show, nobody seems to want it, so I'm not sure what's happening.
That's interesting, yeah, because I just kind of wanted to, ask you basically how things are actually when you do the interview, because it always, it's so interesting. I guess they travel down there to meet up with you, and then, they give you about, 2-3 minutes on the entire documentary,
At the most,
exactly. I mean, how's your feel of it? How are you approached, so to speak? Are these, good guys who want to do a good, decent job, or what's your sense of it?
Well, my experience has been both dealing with and being involved with people who are trying to sell programs to some of the more credible channels, such as National Geographic or Discovery. I find that they shy away from certain subjects, and they do not want to delve too hard into others. For example, recently the Discovery Channel aired an hour-long program on chemtrails.
Oh, really?
It was really quite interesting, but it was also, I guess I'd have to style it as propaganda, because for about the first half of the program, they acknowledged that this spraying program from high-flying airplanes was taking place, and then the rest of the program was devoted to try to convince us all that there was nothing unusual or dangerous in the spray, and they went for 10 or 15 minutes explaining all the workings of the scientific instruments that they were going to use to analyze spent jet fuel.
Okay.
But lost in all of that was the fact, as they stated, that they had only gone to a local airport and bought conventional jet fuel, then taken it to a laboratory and burned it through a jet engine and then taken the residue for analysis. Well, obviously, the commercial jet fuel at a local airport is not going to contain any of the known quantities of material that has been found in these chemtrails, namely barium and sodium fluoride and pathogens. But the very telling point of this was they did mention briefly that the United States military, in the form of the U.S. Air Force, had refused to allow them to analyze their jet fuel. So, to me, the whole thing was kind of specious. It's like, so what? You know, what we want to know is what they're actually spraying, not what can be found in conventionally bought aviation fuel.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. I mean, how are things down in Texas? I mean, you have a I guess a lot of, you know, years to look up at the sky, so to speak. Are things
That's
different?
True.
Are things different?
I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, which was the home not only of the what we used to call the bomber plant, had produced bombers going back to World War II, and then produced B-52s, and later through General Dynamics was producing some of the more modern aircraft. But it was also the home of the Strategic Air Command. And so I grew up watching these giant planes fly over and leave their vapor trails, and I was quite familiar with that. And starting in the mid to late 1990s, I noticed, though, that the trails that were being left by very, very high-flying, apparently military craft, were not dissipating. They were not evaporating back into the air. They were, in fact, spreading out and causing a milky white cloud cover. Covered the entire sky, and that began my interest in research into what has come to be known as chemtrails, chemical trails.
Absolutely.
You see, a normal vapor trail, they're called contrails, and that's short for condensation trail. When a aircraft engine, whether piston or jet, at high altitudes in that cold upper air, it condenses the air into a water vapor, which kind of which then streams out behind the aircraft. But as soon as these trails cool off, then they evaporate right back into the cold air, and so they will stream out behind a plane, but then they fairly quickly evaporate. Chemtrails go from horizon to horizon, and they never evaporate. They spread out until they blend into a milky cloud cover. Now, the reason for this is what we're all trying to find out. The most positive view of it is that they are trying to create a cloud cover to reflect ultraviolet rays and hence hold down global warming. And this makes some sense to me because the old journalist adage is to follow the money. And if global warming effects continue to increase, as we have seen, with more and more larger and more hurricanes, tornadoes, tsunamis, you know, this could create havoc in the insurance industry. And if the insurance industry should collapse, it would probably mean the collapse of the U.S. economy, which, of course, is the basis for much of the Western world's economy. So you can see why that certain people would be very concerned about trying to hold all that together. But the problem is that by spraying barium, aluminum oxide, and other chemicals into the atmosphere, we have seen a corresponding increase in respiratory problems, in fact resulting in many, many thousands of deaths of older citizens and younger people, children who are not able to cope with this. This is something I think that should be of a great concern to everyone because we all have to breathe the same air. And yet this whole program, this whole issue, is basically being buried by the corporate control mass media. They just don't want to talk about it, or if they do talk about it, they brush it off as just misidentified contrails.
And it's, I guess you could see this on two different perspectives. I mean, one thing that comes to mind for me at least is, you know, being these guys, why not tell the truth, considering the fact that, you know, global warming is, you know, very much on the wall these days, and it's almost like a hip topic in that sense.
Yeah, exactly. You would think that they'd want to come clean and say, yeah, we're spraying into the upper atmosphere, just as was suggested years ago by Dr. Edward Teller, heavy minerals in the upper atmosphere to reflect ultraviolet rays. And we're doing this, you know, to try to save us all from global warming.
Yeah.
But they won't even admit to that. And I think the reason for this is that if they admit even that they have this aerosol spraying program in operation, I think there would be an immediate groundswell from the public demanding to know exactly what was in there. And once they found out that it's heavy metals, which can cause problems with both physically and mentally with the human person, that I think you could see that there would rapidly probably grow to be some opposition to this, and I don't think they don't want to have to deal with any kind of opposition. They just want to do what they want to do.
How about this one then? If we turn it around and let's say that this is the reverse, that they actually are trying to create the global warming.
That has been suggested too, and of course, due to the fact that they won't even acknowledge that it's going on, lend some support to that idea that there's a ulterior motive,
sure,
other than beneficial, that's being applied here.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I mean, in regards to, you know, creating a world government and all of this, you know, the ongoing agenda on that level. A global warming, a catastrophe in that regard would very much bring, you know, governments together for a, you know, one world solution, basically. It's a perfect cover, I guess, right?
Right. Well, you know, this also kind of ties in with another ongoing controversy, which is the fluoridation of the water supplies. Two-thirds of the United States municipal water supplies are now being doctored with fluoride. And I would refer your listeners to the letter from a Mr. Charles Elliott Perkins, who was one of the U.S.'s most foremost industrial chemists. Right after World War II, the U.S. government sent him to Germany to help manage the giant IG Farben chemical combine. And in 1954, he wrote to the Lee Foundation for Nutritional Research, and he stated that, quote, the German chemist worked out a very ingenious and far-reaching plan of mass control, which was submitted to and adopted by the German general staff. This plan was to control the population in any given area through mass medication of drinking water. In this scheme of mass control, sodium fluoride occupied a prominent place. The real purpose is not to benefit children's teeth. The real purpose behind water fluoridation is to reduce the resistance of the masses to domination and control and loss of liberty. And of course, it is a historic fact that the Nazis put fluoridated water in the drinking water of their concentration camps to keep the prison population passive and non-resistant to their control. That's pretty scary stuff, isn't it?
Oh my God! Yeah, indeed. I mean, and the fluoridation, it, as I see it at least, is very much connected, you know, with the whole aluminum industry and the phosphor. When they take phosphor out of, you know, when they create it to pour on farms and you know all of that stuff.
Right.
And I mean, this goes
back. Well, fluoride, of course, has long been used in rat poison. In fact, I was kind of surprised to find out that Prozac, which is, you know, one of the antidepressant drugs most commonly being prescribed here in the United States and in other countries as well, is 97% fluoride.
Yeah. It's amazing.
So when you take this fluoridation of the U.S. population and other populations and you add in the chemtrails and then you add in the all of the different chemicals and drugs that are being put into our food supply, like the Monsanto's Terminator seeds that don't allow the crops to go to seed.
Exactly.
And the growth hormones that are all being included. I think you can see that we've probably got a really large-scale public health issue here, but it's not really being addressed.
Absolutely, and this obviously, you know, ties things back, at least to us, in the most recent news about all the bees disappearing, because could there be a connection here?
Well, absolutely. When you're spraying poison all over the place, chances are you're going to get the bees.
Sure.
Now, the bee thing is especially worrisome because Albert Einstein was once quoted as saying that if the bee population disappears in 4 years, man will disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bees, of course, are the ones who pollinate and cross-pollinate the crops, which are eaten by the animals, which are our food supply. So in other words, in 4 years, there's no food supply.
Mm-hmm.
And what really is kind of amazing to me is that, you know, we're getting this right now that in Europe and in the United States, there is this mass die-off of the bee population. And what's 4 years from now? 2012. very date that the Mayan calendar and many other ancient prophecies say is going to be the end of the world, or at least of this cycle.
Absolutely, yeah, indeed. Oh, my God. Okay,
so
I mean,
as the old Chinese curse says, may you live in interesting times.
Indeed. I mean, do you think that all of this then could actually be a plan to instigate this, you know, catastrophe, or is this something that happens?
Well, it certainly could. Mm-hmm. We have seen other programs. We've seen drugs put out that end up killing more people than they cure, and then, of course, once people finally realize this, they're withdrawn, but then usually taken to third world countries to sell. We can see all programs all throughout human history that one group wants to try to eradicate another group, and let me point this out to you. We're all concerned about global warming, but if you listen to some of the would-be rulers and leaders, for instance, Al Gore's popular movie, where he's talking about we have to do something about global warming, and of course he advocates just everybody giving up their cars and we don't want to drive internal combustion engines anymore, and we have to, undergo much more government regulation and restrictions. And yet, what's not being pointed out to people is that yes, there is a problem on this planet with global warming, but it's not relegated to just this planet.
Exactly.
The sun is supposed to have been going into a period of decreasing sunspot and solar flares, and yet we see that the sun is actually heating up.
Yeah.
The polar caps on Mars are melting. The moon of Neptune, Triton, has been shown to be heating up. The outer planets are more luminescent now than ever, indicating that they are heating up.
Yeah.
So this is not really global warming. This is solar system warming.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, of course, what are we going to do about that? Well, we can't figure out what to do about that until we figure out what's causing it.
Exactly.
And nobody's real sure on what's causing it. Although, to me, one of the best ideas is actually goes back to the 80s when it was announced in the news media in this country that scientists had discovered a 10th planet out there that's approaching our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been called by various names, the 10th planet, Planet X, Nibiru, Wormwood, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But if this is true, then what I see is that as this planet approaches the solar system, celestial mechanics come into play, and we see all these disturbances and perturbations taking place within the solar system, even though this planet hasn't really arrived here yet.
Hmm. That's very interesting. You know, I saw a documentary called Five Ways to Save the Earth, and these were five propositions from five different scientists that actually proposed to put up, huge mirrors, up in space and to block out the sunlight. And they even had a, and in there even was a a proposition to actually create as what was referred to as a sulfur screen, basically rockets going up into hundreds of rockets, of course, which spew up, you know, numerous amounts of CO2 and so forth, but no mention
right,
of that.
Which is only going to cause us more problems.
Yeah, exactly.
It does block sunlight.
Exactly.
I think a more viable method may be to simply produce a cloud cover that mm-hmm. could cover the world and reflect the UV rays, and then, but of course, that's going to cause more warming. And then the problem is, how do we create enough clouds to cover the Earth?
Yeah.
And I don't think that may be possible within our current technology unless we break the embargo of secrecy and silence over the reality of UFOs and their non-human occupants. Then begin to try to utilize this alien technology to try to save the planet.
I mean, I totally agree with you, but in regards to, I mean, those who then might not want to go there for whatever reason, you know, politicians or whatever, they should at least be interested in, you know, subsidizing and helping to develop stuff like, you know, the air car. There is a French company now who has brought forward a combustion engine with actually runs on compressed air. So, I mean, why isn't that, you know, happening?
Exactly. And I'm reminded of the story that in Berlin at the end of World War II, when the city was mostly in ruins and they didn't have any petroleum-based gasoline supplies, they had a bus that ran on circular magnets and a kind of a giant spring, and every night they'd roll it into the barn and they would sit there and like wind this thing up and then during the day, by engaging and disengaging, they ran this bus all around the city. It kept operating and it wasn't running on any fuel whatsoever. These things have been around forever, but they have been suppressed by the people who want to maintain their power and control through the wealth of their monopolies over energy, pharmaceuticals, communications, transportation, etc.
Yeah. It's a no-brainer when you kind of get down to it in that sense. I mean,
that's right. But it's a no-brainer if you're aware of all of this and aware of the potential and the alternatives. Unfortunately, most people, certainly here in the United States, where they're too distracted by sports and celebrities and everything in the world except what really affects them, they simply don't know that this stuff exists.
Sure. Yeah, so and that's I guess where we lie today, the problem of people, you know, becoming interested in, you know, in their own environment and what's going on the planet. And but who knows? I mean, I guess that a, you know, more catastrophic scenario would actually hopefully help people to awaken from that slumber.
Well,
I know,
but I hate to get deep into a catastrophe. People begin to realize we need to do something. I'd like to, just for a change, instead of reacting to things, I'd like to proact, try to do something to stop all this. A thought just occurred to me that you might find interesting is that what we're talking about here is ignorance versus knowledge. And historically, and in researching my book, Ruled by Secrecy, I came to realize that in earlier times, this give and take between ignorance and knowledge was referred to as the struggle between light and dark. Which of course goes back to biblical prophecy that says, you know, in the end times there's going to be this big conflict between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. And once you understand that light and darkness refer to knowledge and ignorance, then obviously the winning strategy is to educate people.
I totally agree. It's fascinating stuff, you know. I did want to kind of address, I guess we could go in a little bit different area here. I don't know if you have read up on this or what have you, but I saw on your news section on your site that you had the link to an article or called the 9/11 Mystery Plane. This is something I didn't read the whole piece, quite a lengthy article. I linked it up myself on my website, but it's quite an interesting story.
It's a fascinating story, and it's one that is fully documented. It's not like some theory.
Sure.
And basically, the story is that on 9/11, at the time when the two Trade Center towers had been struck by aircraft and when they had ordered all civilian aircraft grounded, there was a large white jet circling over Washington, D.C., and specifically over the Pentagon and over the White House, to the most restricted areas in the country. And it was photographed. It was even mentioned by CNN reporters. And it looks, for all the world, like one of those big AWACS electronic command planes. And yet the Air Force says it wasn't theirs. So I think there's a real question there that someone in authority should be forced to answer, which is, what was this giant plane circling in restricted Washington airspace at the time the Pentagon was struck? And whose was it, and what was it doing?
Yeah, yeah. Any thoughts?
You know, the it's very clear to me that at the Pentagon, having been a award-winning aviation and aerospace writer for a number of years, it is absolutely certain in my mind that a giant Boeing 757 did not crash into the west wall of the Pentagon. If there was something flying, it was much smaller. And because, number one, we have photographs of the damage to the west wall prior to the collapse of the entire wall, and the hole is down at ground level, and it's only about 19 or 20 feet high and about 20 feet wide. Well, how can you get a 757, which has a wingspan of 125 feet and a tail height of 44 feet, that's four stories, how do you get that into essentially a 20 by 20 foot hole? Well, you can't. And if you, and even if it hit there, there would be pieces of the airplane lying all over the lawn, which of course there were not. And the key thing there is that the FBI that afternoon went around and confiscated more than 80 security camera tapes, both at the Pentagon and on surrounding businesses. And to this date, they've only released 16 frames of one tape. And even then, you really can't see an airplane. All you see is a giant explosion. And my question is, if it's if it happened the way that the government says it happened, why can't they show us a picture of the hangar or the warehouse where they have assembled the wreckage of Flight 11?
Sure, absolutely.
And why can't they show us pictures of that wreckage? We've seen none of this. All we have is a conspiracy theory that this Hani Hanjour, this this Arab Muslim hijacker with little or no flying skills. In fact, just a few weeks before, he had been denied renting a Cessna 150 because he wasn't competent enough to fly it.
Sure.
So how can he fly a big 757, and particularly since the radar track shows that whatever this plane was made a 270-degree circular turn, leveling out at ground level and coming at full speed into the side of the Pentagon, which is what the official story is. And yet, I'm going to tell you and your listeners, it's physically impossible, because when a plane is flying through the air, it builds up a pocket, a cushion of air under it, okay? And when it's at speed, this is why all airplanes have to slow down and almost come to a standstill to land. And if, on just a small Cessna, you have 20 feet or so below it that builds up this air pocket, and it could not possibly land until it cuts its speed to the point to where that air pocket goes away. Now, on a 757, you could have as much as 60 feet of air pocket. So, in other words, it's physically impossible for a 757 flying at 500 miles an hour to get that close to the ground.
So it just kind of would not bounce, maybe, but it, it couldn't be possible in regards to
the force.
But it
didn't bounce. Now, although this is interesting, initially, the official government word was that it hit the ground and bounced into the Pentagon.
Sure.
The problem there was that some of the first responders and some of the people on the highway nearby had digital cameras, and they all started snapping pictures, And I think even before the end of the day on 9/11, some of these pictures were appearing on the internet, and it showed this perfectly clean green lawn in front of the west wall of the Pentagon. So the government had to revise their story and say, oh, okay, wait a minute, it didn't hit the ground and bounce in the Pentagon. It just hit right directly in, and the wings folded back and the tails folded back, and it became like a torpedo, and it just buried itself into the building and then exploded in such a huge explosion of jet fuel that it just melted the whole plane. Okay? And yet, I talked to a woman who was in the Pentagon and who crawled through the hole to get to safety. How could she have survived if there was that kind of fire going on? And then we see the photographs of when the wall collapses, and up on the second, third, and fourth floors, there are offices that are now open to the air once the wall collapsed, and we see wooden tables and computer models and and even a book lying open there. They're not damaged. So wait a minute. What's with this huge, giant fire that immolated the whole plane?
Oh, my God. It's a huge, huge hole in this story, at least. I mean, do you think
Exactly. And, you know, this is why I am pushing for trying to solve the mysteries and controversies of 9/11, because that could be the crack in the door that could open to a lot of other things, such as the chemtrails and the secret testing, and the mechanizations that are going on in the world today.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So do you think that the 9/11 mystery plane actually might be Flight 77 that didn't hit the Pentagon?
No, I don't think so, because it looks like, and there is even a, I think the article you mentioned has a fairly decent shot of it. It's got a bulge on the top of it. It's got a stripe down the side. It seems to have an American flag on the tail. This is the markings of one of these electronic command aircraft. And if you want a theory, the theory seems to be that this was the craft that was controlling the missile that was fired into the Pentagon.
I see. Okay. That's interesting.
And a similar type plane was seen over New York, and the conspiracy theorist surmised that that may have been the plane that guided the remotely controlled aircraft into the two Twin Towers. And the idea of remotely controlled aircraft is nothing outlandish. We have Global Hawk technology and had it prior to 9/11. In fact, in the summer of 2001, a Boeing 737 took off from Edwards Air Force Base in California and flew to Australia, and there flew 12 missions, and then flew back to the United States and landed safely, all with nobody on board. It was being controlled remotely. And so we have that technology. And it's been stated, even by President Bush himself, a few weeks after 9/11 in the New York Times, when he talked about new technology that could prevent hijacking, and that is basically this remote control. See, the big modern wide-belly jets that are made by Boeing, the 737, 757, 767, they are what they call fly-by-wire, which means they are computer-controlled. Now, if it's computer-controlled, then we have a situation where if you can produce a signal that will override the signal being sent to the plane's computer, then you can gain outside control of that aircraft, and you can guide it and have it do whatever you want it to do, regardless of what hijackers might want, or even the flight crew. And there is a pretty widely held belief that these airplanes on 9/11 were under remote control. Well, of course, that would leave the question, then, where were they controlled from? And there are various theories there, but of course, since there has not yet been a serious, honest, and in-depth investigation of 9/11, we don't have the answers to all of that.
Indeed. How about the idea that, you know, Building 7 actually was kind of a control center for all of this, and that was
Exactly. That had a huge protected command center in there, and yet it fell down on about 5:25 on the afternoon of 9/11. And again, to tell you, to show you and illustrate how that there has not been any kind of meaningful investigation. The so-called 9/11 Commission, which was formed almost 2 years after 9/11, after President Bush had dragged his heels for almost 2 years, he finally was forced to create a 9/11 Commission, and his first choice to head the investigation was Henry Kissinger, which is really fascinating because almost everybody agrees that the attacks of 9/11 were probably as the result of our foreign policy, and the architect of that foreign policy was Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, indeed.
Of course, it became very obvious very fast that this was a case of putting the fox in charge of the hen house, so he bowed out, and we got some other people in there.
Sure.
But to illustrate what kind of a probing investigation they mounted, I would point out that nowhere in the 9/11 Commission report do they even address Building 7.
Yeah.
They don't even talk about it. It's like it didn't happen. And yet we've all seen the videotapes, and I can remember from watching TV that afternoon. They said, we're going back to New York. This building has collapsed. And we see the picture of the center of the building falling in, caving in, and the whole building falls in on itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
A classic building implosion.
Indeed.
A controlled demolition. And in fact, what has now kind of raised the issue even higher is that here recently somebody put on the internet a BBC report where their announcer was announcing the collapse of Building 7. And the only problem was this was about almost 30 minutes before it collapsed. And while the person is talking, you can actually see the building still standing in the background.
Yeah, standing in the background.
So, and you know, I think somebody needs to know, how did BBC know this building was going to collapse?
Exactly. And who's feeding these people with the news then?
Exactly. Exactly.
So, I mean, again, more and more of these things are coming to light because, you know, again, people are interested in this, and that's why it's, you know, so important to keep an eye on all of this. How about the, I mean, I guess we could say we have another missing plane. I don't know what your take on it in regards to United Airlines Flight 93. Do you think that that was shot down?
At this point, I do not subscribe to the idea that it was shot down, and I'll tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that it was destroyed in midair.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I can say that with certainty is because, again, as a former aviation aerospace writer, a plane that is driven into the ground leaves a big crater, lots of debris. Usually the tail section survives. It'll be sticking up. And the rest of it's just a huge mess. But it's all concentrated right there where the crash took place. Even according to the official version, Flight 93 left an 8-mile-long debris trail. Mail, pieces of bodies, seats, you name it. That plane was coming apart in midair, which also explains the lack of a credible amount of wreckage at the crash site. Okay? So, that, of course, is what fueled the fire of people who want to say that it was shot down. I recall seeing an interview, though, with the F-16 pilot who was shadowing Flight 93, and he, number one, reveals and admitted that he was in the midst of war game exercises, which we know were taking place on the morning of 9/11. He said that he only had dummy ammunition and no missiles. So in other words, he couldn't have shot that plane down even if he'd wanted to. In fact, he said that the thought crossed his mind that perhaps he was going to have to suicide himself and crash into the plane to try to stop it from heading to a populated area. But he said, thank God I didn't have to make that decision because he saw black smoke and he saw it going down. All this black smoke in midair and the fact that it was taking a plunge towards the earth was also seen by another civilian pilot nearby who was trying to find a place to land because he'd been ordered to, quit flying and under the no-fly zone. And so that plane was coming apart in midair. Well, if the fighter pilot could not have shot it down, then what happened? In one of the few instances where they have tape recordings from the flight deck, we hear apparently one of the hijackers claimed that there was a bomb on board. Okay? So perhaps they did bring a bomb on board, or perhaps a bomb was planted on board. And my scenario is that I think the story of the passengers' revolt, let's roll, was probably true. Because one of the passengers at the rear of the plane had been talking on a rear seat radio telephone to his wife, and his wife had told him about all the carnage in New York. And I'm sure then that he would have told his fellow passengers, and once they realized that unless they do something, they're probably going to be crashed into something and all be killed. So I think they did revolt, and I think they did try to regain the cockpit. And in fact, they may have accomplished that. But at that point, they may have realized that they couldn't control the plane because it was under Global Hawk technology remote control. And at that point, too, whoever was actually behind these attacks realized that if that plane crash-landed or landed safely and the passengers and the flight crew were still alive, then the game was up because they would tell everybody and reveal that they couldn't control the plane. It did come under remote control. So I think somebody triggered the bomb on board, and they blew that plane out of the sky. Now, that's my personal theory based on everything I know.
Do you think that the you know, the hijackers, as it were, the Muslims actually were part in this, in the sense that they were part of it as they thought that this was a drill, you know, the entire thing?
I think that the Arab hijackers, and I hesitate to call them Muslims, they did not act as devout Muslims would have. If they were devout Muslims and they were going on a holy mission and they were going to face Allah, then you think that they would be saying their prayers and getting their souls right with God the night before. And instead, we have very verified and well-documented reporting from the Philadelphia Inquirer and other papers that these guys were out drinking, smoking, and looking for hookers. Well, this sounds more like mercenaries on the night before an operation. I think these guys were Arab mercenaries hired by who knows who. Could have been the CIA, could have been the Mossad, could have been Al-Qaeda. But they were hired and put up to this by somebody, and they then conducted these hijackings. The planes were then captured by electronic remote control, and I don't think those guys realized that they were on a suicide mission.
That seems a kind of a probable scenario at this point, at least. With a
For example, we're told that Mohammed Atta was the leader of the hijack team, and we're also told that he had a rent car that he left in the parking lot of Boston Logan Airport, and in the back seat they found a suitcase, and in the suitcase was a Koran. Which would support the idea that he was a devout Muslim. Also, flight manuals, well, how incriminating. Why would he leave something like that behind? And other things showing that he was some sort of terrorist. And then the whole thing just stinks to me. If he's going on a suicide mission, why does he need a suitcase? And if you think, wait a minute, he took a suitcase so that he could be seen as just another normal traveler, right? Okay, so why'd he leave it in the car? I mean, it's just, to me, so obvious that that's just planted evidence.
Yeah, indeed. It's one thing I did wanted to kind of get in here also, ask you about this. Of course, Rosie O'Donnell over there is creating a lot of noise about this. Do you think that, you know, she'll be able to bring some new people to the 9/11 field? Have you heard about this?
Oh, yes. And I hold her in high esteem, although keep in mind, all she's done is just raise some pertinent questions.
Indeed.
And yet, in the land of the home of the brave and the land of the free, she's being pilloried just for raising questions.
Yeah.
But yes, she got that on a very large audience national show, and I think that that's going to kind of pique a lot of people's curiosity. I think they're going to start going and looking and maybe reading my book, The Terror Conspiracy, maybe looking at some of the good videos and some of the websites that are out there. And all you have to do is look at the evidence.
Yeah.
The only way that you cannot believe that 9/11 was an inside job is to refuse to look at the evidence and simply buy on faith the official conspiracy theory of the U.S. government.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you agree to that?
I mean, in regards to, I just had to squeeze this in regards to Rosie before I get, they actually, has set up a website called StopRosie.com. And I mean, and they're trying to get her off the air because, you know.
Right. And for why? For raising questions.
Yeah.
How's that for freedom in the box?
Exactly, exactly. It's amazing.
See, and that shows you how desperate they're becoming, though, because it could be just my perception because I've dealt with it so long, since the very day it happened. And it could be because I still deal with it, and people send me emails daily with new evidence, new information, new insights. But I swear, it seems to me that there is a growing awareness on the part of the U.S. population that there's something very, very wrong with 9/11, and that we need to reevaluate what happened there.
Yeah, indeed. And again,
most of the rest of the world, especially in Europe, you guys seem to have a better handle on it than we do.
Yeah, I don't know. It's always difficult to obviously generalize and so forth. But I think, I mean, from up here, people are in Sweden, people are pretty much don't know what's going on, unfortunately. But
so it's pretty much the same everywhere, right? You've got a pretty substantial amount of people who are aware, seeking, looking, knowledgeable, but then you got a bigger bulk that they just going about their daily lives. They don't want to be bothered with.
Yeah, yeah. And if you, I mean, again, as you say, I think if you approach people, in an intelligent way and can ask the right questions in the kind of right way, so to speak, I guess most people would, not shy away from it immediately. I mean, some people, I guess, could go into fear mode and basically dismiss everything out of hand. But I think the important thing is to ask the right questions at the right time. I mean, and people differ on that, on when that is and so forth. But I think that is the way. Yeah.
And Henrik, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. You're not going to get anywhere by trying to preach to people. Just make them defensive, and then they just bury themselves further down in their little hole of ignorance.
Yeah.
What you do is just in a friendly and neighborly type way, just raise the questions. And like if one of them says, "Oh boy, they ought to do something about Rosie O'Donnell," well, ask them. Why should they do something to someone who only raised some questions?
Yeah.
If they go, well, they should not criticize their government, and say, well, the government themselves have not answered our question.
Yeah.
Why do you think that Building 7 collapsed when it had not been hit by aircraft?
Exactly.
And if they've read some of the debunking material, they're going to say, it was debris from the Twin Towers that flew hundreds of yards past Buildings 5 and 6 and created a huge hole there in Building 7, which caused it to collapse.
Yeah.
Say, oh, really? Well, look, wait a minute. Here was a rectangular building, and if you take out a quarter or a third of it, whether it's on one end or the other, or even in the center, doesn't it make sense that the building would have toppled over in the direction of the hole? Get them to think about it. Get them to think and use their brains.
I totally agree. Yeah, and again, being curious about it and just being able to look at. But again, I mean, it goes back to the fact that most people actually seek externally for some kind of authority to tell them what's going on and so forth. That's why they have these guys coming on the news, the spin masters. You can watch a news piece, then you have this expert coming in and telling you what you should think about what you've seen.
And you know what? As a reporter who covered court trials for years and years and years, the one thing I came to understand quite clearly was if you have enough money, you can hire an expert to testify to anything you want to hear.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, excuse me, but you cannot trust experts.
Exactly.
I can think of a dozen examples, but I guess maybe the best one was the fellow who, prior to the U.S. setting off its first atomic bomb in 1945, said, look, I've been in the field of explosives all my life, and I can assure you this will never work. Now, there's an expert. So,
exactly.
You know, experts can be hired. They can be turned. For example, I'll tell you how I think that they've managed many of the experts on 9/11.
Mm.
They go to someone, say a building engineer with lots of credentials, and they say, look, if this happened and this happened, and then this collapsed and this gave way, couldn't it all have fallen down like this?
Mm.
And they go, yeah. and they go, here, this expert says it could happen that way. Of course,
yeah.
The problem is, his decision and conclusion was based on a whole number of assumptions which may or may not have been true at all.
Sure, exactly.
For example, they've tried to explain how these floors pancaked on top of each other, which if you picture a tall building with a lot of floors and the top floors give way and they hit the floor below them and that's added weight, pushes that floor down and it pancakes all the way down, that on the surface seems to make pretty good sense.
Mm.
But if you stop and really look at the facts, you find that in both of those buildings, they had these gigantic steel cores, 47 huge girders welded together by cross pieces. Those things are not going to give way.
No.
Okay? If it happened, the pancake theory happened as the way they said it did, what we should have seen was something like the old phonograph where all the records drop to the bottom and you've got that steel shank standing up through the top.
Yeah.
But we didn't see that. All of that was gone. Everything was gone. And that's another thing that a lot of people don't know or realize or have not stopped to think about. According to the official sources and the mass media, the collapse of those 210-story buildings should have produced 4.5 million tons of debris, which would have stacked up to 10 stories high.
Hmm.
And yet, we've all seen the pictures, it was almost flat at ground zero. There was not enough debris to go up to perhaps 2 stories, if at that much. And then by their own accounts, they only hauled away 1.5 million tons of debris.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot of debris, but it's not 4.5 tons of debris. So what happened to the other 3 tons of debris?
Indeed. You know, and one fascinating aspect of all of this is, of course, the the incredible heat that was reportedly
exactly.
under the
yeah,
buildings.
They found molten steel 6 weeks after the event down underground. It was still molten. In fact, the ground was so hot it was melting the rubber boots of the construction workers.
Yeah.
Now, what could have caused that? Not jet fuel, just slightly refined kerosene, and it certainly wouldn't have lasted that long. I think what we're seeing here is the telltale signs of some sort of exotic explosives, perhaps even nuclear.
Yeah, exactly. That's
and that could account for the fact that the whole steel cores were just disintegrated.
Yeah, exactly.
So it could also account for the fact that in every other building in history, stone, concrete, steel-reinforced building that may have collapsed due to earthquake, none of them have ever collapsed due to fire.
No.
But there have been some buildings that have collapsed due to earthquake, but if you go on the Internet, look at the pictures, you'll find that they all topple over to one side or the other, and they're all, for all practical purposes, still there. They just fell over.
Yeah.
In the World Trade Center, you had all this concrete that just turned to powdery dust and covered everything.
Yeah.
It was just totally disintegrated. Now, what could do that? Not jet fuel.
No.
Not just a collapsing building.
No.
And by the way, I have a big coffee table type book that was done by a professional photographer who went and shot pictures all around the World Trade Center. And on page 201, he's got this fascinating picture of a parking meter that's just orange and black and melted and charred, and it's bent over. And the cut line says, I often wondered as I walked along Barclay Street what it was that did this to the parking meters. There were at least 8 of them, all leaning over the sidewalk at a 30-degree angle, their bodies charred and their plastic faces melted away. Now, this is hundreds of yards from the World Trade Center, so again, when you somebody says, "Oh, well, it's just conspiracy theories," just ask them in a polite way.
Yeah.
What could have bent parking meters and charred them hundreds of feet away from the World Trade Center if it was just a fire and the building just collapsed?
Yeah.
This is just more evidence of an explosion.
Indeed, amazing. Yeah, amazing stuff. You know, Jim, I think that would be an excellent place to kind of round off this segment, and we'll continue in the subscriber section. But before we do that, I want to give you an opportunity to you know, mention your books you got out there, and your most recent one, obviously.
Right. Well, I'm starting to get lots of emails from people going, "Wow, did you know war game exercises were taking place? Did you know that they had insured those buildings against the terrorist attack?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know about the short selling of stock?" And I just kind of want to wring my hands, because all of that is in my book, The Terror Conspiracy,
yeah.
Most of which was written in 2002,
yeah.
Just immediately following 9/11.
Hmm.
But it got suppressed. And it's taken me this long to get it all back together and out into the public, but it's there now. So if you want the details, and if you want the sources, there's 31 pages of sources. If you want the straight information and all of the information that puts 9/11 into a comprehensible overview, then by all means get my book, The Terror Conspiracy.
Terror Conspiracy,
Deception,
yeah.
9/11, and the Loss of Liberty.
Indeed, and of course you have also Rule by Secrecy and Alien Agenda. And, are all those available on jimmorris.com?
Right, right, jimmorris.com. Visit the website, or you can get all of these books at any bookstore.
Excellent.
If they don't have it on the shelf, they can order it pretty quick.
Excellent. Okay, Jim, so for this segment, thank you very much, and we will continue in the subscriber section.
Thank you.